As you see, dear brothers and sisters, we are to look at Ezekiel, the prophet, and his mission with our brother Peter Southgate. And he's asked by way of introduction that we should read from Ezekiel chapter 3, and Brother Mark will lead us, please.
Thank you, Brother Mark. We now look forward to the remarks that our brother Peter has prepared to talk to us about Ezekiel, the prophet, and his mission. Peter.
My dear brethren and sisters, as with most Bible characters, it's impossible to understand the man or his mission unless we appreciate the background of his life and times. This is very eventful in Ezekiel's case, so we want to spend the first few minutes sketching in that background. First of all, we consider the religious situation. Back in the land of Judah and Jerusalem, we're at the time of the last days of the kings of Judah. And during those last few reigns, the worship of God had been completely corrupted. We've been reading of this in our readings from Ezekiel, from 2 Kings in the last few days. We've read how Manasseh did more to provoke God to anger than any of the kings before him. He even set up idols in the temple in Jerusalem. He indulged in that terrible worship of Baal, which involved offering children as sacrifices in the valley of Gehinnom. He was followed by Josiah, a good king who tried very hard to reform the kingdom of Judah. But that reform was only superficial. Jeremiah, speaking at that time, said that Judah had returned to God, but feignedly. They didn't really mean it when they adopted the reforms of Jeremiah. And on Josiah's death, his sons, first Jehoahaz, then Jehoiakim, and then Jehoiachin, followed in fairly quick succession, and they took the nation back to idolatry. And yet, despite this, amazingly so, the Jews were still very confident of God's blessing. They reasoned that God had chosen Israel as his people. He had chosen Jerusalem and the temple to place his name there. He'd promised to David a perpetual throne. The temple was the house of God. And they couldn't conceive of Jerusalem ever being destroyed. Look at Jeremiah chapter 7 to give an idea of their attitude in regard to this. Jeremiah chapter 7. Looking first of all at verse 4. And Jeremiah was saying to these people in Jerusalem, "Trust ye not in lying words, saying, 'The temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord are these.'" See, that was the thing that they relied on, that they had the temple there. And Jeremiah goes on to say, verse 10, verse 9, "Will ye steal, murder, and commit adultery?" And then verse 10, "And come and stand before me in this house, which is called by my name, and say, 'We are delivered to do all these abominations.'" And then God says, having referred to the destruction of the tabernacle at Shiloh, says in verse 14, "Therefore I will do to this house, which is called by my name, wherein ye trust, and unto the place which I gave to your fathers, as I have done to Shiloh." And the reason why Judah had this confidence that they would never be taken away from Jerusalem or the temple be destroyed was because of all the false prophets that were allegedly giving them a message from God, but in actual fact it was a message from their own heart. The Jews failed to realize, as has been predicted so often in the Law of Moses, that the tenure of their land was conditional on their obedience. And in fact, Jeremiah, and then Ezekiel, as we'll see in a few moments, was to tell them that the destruction of Jerusalem and of the temple was imminent. When we come to think of it, coming forward to Christ's day, that was exactly the attitude of the Jews then, wasn't it? You know, we be Abraham's children, never been in bondage to any man. But Jesus had to remind them that that position was dependent on what they believed and how they acted. If you were the children of Abraham, he said, you would do the works of Abraham. So that then is the religious background to both what was going on in Jerusalem and what Ezekiel had to combat away in Babylonia. Let's now talk about the political background of these times. We have Babylon to the north, Judah in the middle, and Egypt to the south. And there was little Judah sandwiched between these two great powers. The Babylonians were just reaching the zenith of their power. Until comparatively recently, Assyria had been the dominant power, but Babylon had increased and had gradually eroded the territory and the power of Assyria. The Assyrians had taken Israel into captivity, first of all, about 100 years before Ezekiel's day. And then Israel were to go into captivity. They were to settle in Babylon. But in the south, there was still this very great power of Egypt, a dominant power. And the Egyptians felt that it was their role to try and stem this increase in power and influence of Babylon to the north. And so they often resisted the power of Babylon. And this came to a crisis in the Battle of Carchemish. Carchemish is where that little red dot is, you see there, on the river Euphrates. Because Pharaoh Necho of Egypt tried to thwart Babylonian expansion by marching his army up to engage Babylon at the place Carchemish on the river Euphrates. But as events transpired, as we know, that was not successful. Josiah tried to stop him going up to Babylon, but he was killed en route. And within a few months, Necho was turning home with, metaphorically, his tail between his legs. But there we have Judah in the middle, this buffer state, tributary to Babylon, who was the dominant power, as all the surrounding nations were. But they often were looking back down south to Egypt for potential help against Babylon. And it was that which caused their final destruction. Now let's express these things diagrammatically. Along the top here we have a date scale, as you can see, and below that we have a line which represents Babylon, the dominant power, and King Nebuchadnezzar, who reigned virtually throughout all this period we're considering. Then down the south we have Egypt. The first king there was Necho, and we've already mentioned that he was weakened by his defeat at the Battle of Carchemish. Then we have Psammeticus. I couldn't get his full name in because it's much too long. He was a rather introvert king, and nothing much happened in his reign. And then he was succeeded by Hophra. And Hophra again took up the mantle of Necho and tried to curtail the power of Babylon. And it was to Hophra that the kings of Judah turned for help, which resulted in their eventual undoing. In fact, Hophra encouraged Judah to rebel against Babylon. So in the middle, we've got the kingdom of Judah with its line of kings. First of all, Jehoiakim, then Jehoiachin, who reigned only 3 months, and then Zedekiah. And it was during the reign of these three kings that the captivities of Judas commenced, and there were three waves of captivities. Let's look at the second book of Kings, which in fact we read yesterday, and we have the record of the first of those captivities. Second book of Kings, chapter 24. And the opening verses. We are told, in his, Jehoiakim's days, end of verse, chapter 23, in Jehoiakim's days, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came up, and Jehoiakim became his servant 3 years. Then he turned and rebelled against him. Looking down now to Pharaoh Hophra in Egypt. Now, although it isn't mentioned here, Nebuchadnezzar, at that very first attack on Jerusalem, took a few captives. Apparently not very many, but he took a lot of the princes, the elite of Judah, and Daniel was amongst them. So this was the occasion when the first captivity went to Babylon, and Daniel was amongst that group of captives. Then, in the days of Jehoiachin, as we learn from verse 10 of this same chapter, speaking of Jehoiachin, verse 8, verse 10 says, at that time the servants of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came up against Jerusalem and the city was besieged. And then Jehoiachin, the king, went out to the king of Babylon. He surrendered to him. Now, this was just a few years, a year or two, after what we read in verse 1 of this chapter, that Jehoiakim had rebelled. It obviously takes a year or two for Babylon to muster his army to come down to put Jehoiakim in his place. But before it had happened, Jehoiakim had died, and the young Jehoiachin was on the throne. And he, when faced with this Babylonian attack, surrendered. He went out to the king of Babylon, him and his mother, and a lot of the princes of the land. And as a result, Nebuchadnezzar was fairly kind to him. He just took him into captivity, and also took most of the people. Verse 14, he carried away all Jerusalem and all the princes, all the mighty men of valor, even 10,000 captives, and all the craftsmen and smiths, none remained, save the poorest sort of the people of the land. So that is the second wave of captives going to Babylon in the days of Jehoiachin. This left, as we just read there, the very poor of the land, and Zedekiah was on the throne. He too, despite the advice of Jeremiah, rebelled against the king of Babylon and turned to Egypt for help. And as a result, he too was subject to an invasion. Jeremiah, Kings chapter 25, verse 1. It came to pass in the ninth year of his, Zedekiah's reign, in the tenth month, in the tenth day of the month, that Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came, he and all his host, against Jerusalem, and pitched against it, and built forts against it. And the city was besieged unto the 11th year of King Zedekiah. So here was an 18-month siege, after which, as we know very well from our recent readings in Jeremiah, the city was completely destroyed, the temple destroyed, and the remnant of the people left in Judah taken captive. So here is the third wave of captivity going to Babylon. So, there was a very crucial period of Israel's history. And God, in his mercy, gave three prophets at this very time. Jeremiah in Judea, Ezekiel in Babylon, who had been taken captive in that second wave, and Daniel, who had been taken captive in the first wave of captivities. And all these three prophets were giving warning and advice to God's people. And they all had the same message to Judah, to repent and do the first works. And so let's think for a moment or two, just briefly, about Jeremiah. He was in Jerusalem predicting the destruction of Jerusalem. And after those had gone into captivity with Jehoiachin's captivity, the major captivity where Ezekiel was taken, he describes those as good figs. They were going to be preserved, but the ones left behind in Jerusalem were bad figs. They were going to be destroyed. And he also reminds them of the futility of trust in Egypt. Look at Jeremiah chapter 28, because this relates now to the commencement of Ezekiel's prophecy. Jeremiah chapter 28, we have the false prophet Hananiah predicting that those who went with Jehoiachin's captivity will be returning within 2 years. And so Jeremiah says, chapter 28, verse 1, "It came to pass in the same year of the beginning of the reign of Zedekiah, king of Judah, in the fourth year and the fifth month," note that, the fourth year and the fifth month, "Hananiah, the son of Azariah, Azar the prophet, was saying that everybody was going to be all right again, the captives were to come back, the temple was going to be rebuilt, etc., etc. But because of this, Jeremiah had to say, verse 9, "The prophet which prophesieth of peace, when the word of that prophet shall come to pass, then shall the prophet be known that the Lord has truly sent him." And then Hananiah repeats verse 11, his claim that everything will be all right after a few years. And then Jeremiah felt it necessary to write to the captives in Babylon, those that went out with Jehoiachin's captivity, to counteract this very vehement approach of Hananiah, saying that they were all going to come back again. So we read in chapter 29 that he wrote a letter to the captives who are now in Babylon, saying, "It's going to be a long time. You're going to be there for 70 years. So, chapter 29, verse 20, "Hear ye therefore the words of the Lord, all ye of the captivity, whom I have sent from Jerusalem to Babylon. Thus saith the word of the host, the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, says that he will destroy the prophets in Babylon who were saying similar things to Hananiah in Jerusalem, and they would be also killed, as they were." And then he went on to say that there would be 70 years of captivity before they would return. So, with this background, it was in the fourth year of Zedekiah that he sent this letter about the persistence of the captivity. And if we now go to Ezekiel chapter 1, we find it's on receipt of this letter from Jeremiah that God caused Ezekiel to take up his prophecy. Because We read in Ezekiel chapter 1 and verse 2, in the fifth day of the month, which was the fifth year of King Jehoiachin's captivity. Now, the fifth year of Jehoiachin's captivity was 5 years, obviously, after they went into Babylon. Jeremiah's letter was 4 years after they had been, because it was in the fourth year of Zedekiah, who commenced reigning when that captivity started. So it's on receipt of this letter from Jeremiah that Ezekiel commences his mission. So what do we know about Ezekiel the man? Well, apart from a few family details, we're told very, very little. His name, the Hebrew Jehezekiel, means God strengthens. Actually, it only occurs twice in the Bible. The message is more important than the man. In fact, Ezekiel, as we know, is usually called the son of man. And he was of priestly descent, we read in verse 3. The word of the Lord came expressly unto Ezekiel, the priest, the son of Buzi, in the land of the Chaldeans, by the river Kebar, one of the canals in Babylon, and the hand of the Lord was there upon him. So he was a priest. He'd come from Jerusalem with Jehoiachin's captivity, so he was almost certainly one who lived in Jerusalem. Probably because of his father's duties in the temple, he must have been very familiar with that building and with the Mosaic ritual that was carried out there. But he was probably too young to have officiated as a priest before he was actually taken by Nebuchadnezzar into Babylon. This is suggested by verse 1 of this first chapter. Now it came to pass in the 30th year, in the fourth month, in the fifth day of the month, as I was among the captives of the river of Kebar. In the 30th year, 30th year from what? There are many suggestions, but the most probable one, that Ezekiel is here referring to the 30th year of his life. He was 30 years old when God appeared to him. And as this was the fifth year of his captivity, we've just read, he would have been 25 when he went into captivity, and that was just too young for him to have commenced his priestly duties as laid down by the law of Moses. So instead, at an age when normally he should have been called to the priesthood, at 30, God calls him to a different ministry, ministry of a prophet. Interesting, the later son of man was called to his ministry at the same age, wasn't he? He was married, he had a house in Babylon, but little other detail is given of his personal life. What was his mission? Well, it was primarily to the Jews in dispersion, those who were in captivity. But he mentions a lot of the name of Israel, not only Judah. So probably he was also directed his mission to those who 100 years or so before had been taken captive by the Assyrians and settled in a similar part of the country. In fact, he later, as we know in chapter 37, refers to the reunification of Israel and Judah under the symbol of the two sticks being joined together. So what was his main theme? First of all, it's God's utter abhorrence of idolatry and disobedience and the inevitable fate of those who practiced it. This especially was directed now at Judah, still back in the land, that remnant there, and the surrounding nations too were going to share a similar fate. And all this was to be executed at the hand of Nebuchadnezzar. And the one political fact that's central to this whole book is the threat of the Babylonian invasion that destroyed Jerusalem and the surrounding countries. That is central to this book of Ezekiel. And then Ezekiel then also makes allusions to the actual campaign of Nebuchadnezzar as the instrument of God's justice. And the other thing that Ezekiel had to do was to convince them that they, those in captivity, were the people of God. You see, there's a tendency to regard the Jews who were still remaining in Jerusalem as the privileged ones, as the lucky ones. They had escaped captivity. Those in the captivity, the ones that God had dispensed with, they were the divine outcast, as it were. And Ezekiel corrects this, just as Jeremiah had done, saying that the good figs were the ones that had gone to Babylon. And then, having given the judgment of God for their iniquity, Ezekiel then, at the end of his book, goes on to give a promise of restoration of the people of God. Now, this commission was given after a dramatic vision in which God appeared to him seated in his symbolic chariot of the cherubim. We haven't got time to go into that, but it recurs frequently throughout this book. In the opening chapters, chapters 8 to 12, and then again in the final vision of the future temple. But in chapter 3 that we read, we have his duties described. Verse 4. Son of man, go, get thee unto the house of Israel, and speak my words unto them. For thou art not sent to a people of a strange speech and of a hard language, but to the house of Israel, not to a people of a strange speech and of a hard language, whose words thou canst not understand. Surely, had I sent thee to them, they would have hearkened unto thee. But the house of Israel will not hearken unto thee, for they will not hearken unto me. For all the house of Israel are impudent and hard-hearted. Behold, I have made thy face strong against their faces, and thy forehead strong against their forehead. Interesting, a little play on Ezekiel's name there, isn't there? Ezekiel means God has strengthened, and here is God saying, I'm going to make you strong to carry out this mission. But his message was not only by means of words, but particularly by actions. There are many acted parables, little scenarios that Ezekiel had to demonstrate. Remember, depicting the siege of Jerusalem was one of them. Moving all his household furniture away was another one. Cutting off his beard was yet another. But possibly the most telling demonstration that he was God's prophet was that when he was speaking God's message, only then was he going to be able to speak. Look at chapter 3 that we read, verse 26 to 27. And I will make thy tongue cleave to the roof of thy mouth, that thou shalt be dumb, and shall not be to them a reprover, for they are a rebellious house. But when I speak with thee, I will open thy mouth, and thou shalt say unto them, Thus saith the Lord God. Just think of that. For probably 5 or 6 years, Ezekiel was unable to communicate with anybody, not even his wife, with all the normal day-to-day affairs of life. He could only speak when he was speaking God's words by inspiration. Truly, what a wonderful sign that must have been, that here was indeed a prophet of the Lord, as contrast to those false prophets who were proclaiming that Israel would be blessed. And again, we think of Christ, the Son of Man. He also spoke God's words under compulsion, didn't he? My Father, he gave me a commandment, what I should say and what I should speak. Going back to Ezekiel, there's another feature of his prophecy, was the use of visions. Ezekiel was carried here, there, and many places, back to Jerusalem, to witness what was going on in the city while he was still in by the river of Kibar. We have the vision of the cherubim, the opening vision. Then he was taken back to Jerusalem to see were the terrible things that were going on in the temple later on. We saw the vision of the Valley of Dry Bones later on in chapter 37. And especially the temple of the future was all conveyed to Ezekiel by visions. And again, we've got another link with Jesus, haven't we? Because the one prophetical book of the Son of Man, Revelation, also is all visions, isn't it? In fact, some see over 100 allusions in Revelation to the prophecy of Ezekiel. We have in Revelation the cherubim, the living creatures. We have John eating the roll, as Ezekiel had to do. We've got the merchandise of Tyre and Babylon, both of which occur in Ezekiel and in Revelation. So then with this introduction, let's look at the prophecy itself. It's the record of Ezekiel's mission. The three main divisions. Chapters 1 to 24 relate to the time before the destruction of Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar. And the message there, as it was in Jeremiah's case, so it was in Ezekiel, Judah was going to be punished if it does not repent. And then chapters 34 to 38, we've got God's promises of restoration for the nation, which extend still yet into the future. And in the middle, between chapters 25 to 33, we've got prophecies mainly against the surrounding nations, because they too were going to suffer at the hand of the Babylonians, some of them because of their treatment of Israel itself. So then, let's again look at Ezekiel's mission. Here we have, in the centre, orange portion, we've got a series of numbers, 6, 7, 8, 22. Those are the years after the Jehoiachin's captivity that Ezekiel was given a message. You see, there's a lot of messages, 6, 7, 8, 11 and 12 years after the captivity. That leads up to the destruction of Jerusalem. Then there's a big gap of 13 years before another prophecy occurs. So let's go through these messages and see how they tie up with the events that were going on in Judah that Ezekiel had to predict. So we come to the fifth year of... It's interesting, incidentally, that all of Ezekiel's prophecies, with one very minor exception, are in chronological order. He goes through from year to year. He starts in the fifth year, in the seventh year, I said this, in the 11th year, this happened. So it's all in chronological order, unlike Jeremiah, which, as we know, is a bit apparently at random. So here we have the fifth year. He prophesied what is contained in chapters 1 to 7. This is 4 years before the siege of Jerusalem commenced. And could I say that the remaining slides I've prepared as a handout, because I know there's a lot there on them, so you might like to take it away and have it in your Bible when we're reading the chapters in the next few weeks. So from chapters 1 to 3, we've had the call of Ezekiel. And then chapters 4 to 7, we have predictions of the coming siege of Jerusalem. Let's grunt through the chapters. Turn to chapter 4. Take the attire. And remember what that was. He had to lie on his side for 390 years and then another 40 years to show that as Jerusalem had sinned against God, so they would be punished, and Ezekiel had to a day for a year lie upon his side. And then chapter 5, take a sharp knife, a barber's razor. He had to cut off his hair, divide it into three portions. A third had to be burnt, A third had to be cut up with a knife, and a third part scattered to the winds, indicating the three ways in which Jerusalem and Judah would be punished: by fire, by sword, and by scattering, if they did not repent. And then, chapters 6 and 7, we're told that, or Ezekiel is told, that the mountains of Israel are going to become desolate because of their idolatry. So verse 25, destruction cometh, and they shall seek peace, and there shall be none. Verse 27, the king shall mourn, the princes shall be clothed in desolation, the hands of the people of the land shall be troubled. I will do unto them after their way, and according to their deserts will I judge them. They shall know that I am the Lord. Now this was the message of the first year. Jerusalem was going to be destroyed, and because of the wickedness of the people and the kings. Then, in the sixth year, we're now only 3 years before the destruction of Jerusalem, before the siege of Jerusalem, I should say. And in the sixth year, there's quite extensive prophecies. Chapters 8 to 19 of Ezekiel were all given in the sixth year. And here we have a general review of the condition of the people back in Jerusalem, as seen from Ezekiel in Babylon. Chapter 8, and it came to pass in the sixth year, he was taken in a vision to Jerusalem, and where he saw those terrible things that were going on in the temple. Verse 5, lifted up mine eyes toward the north. This is the north of the temple in Jerusalem. By the gate of the altar was the image of jealousy. And then in verse 10 and 11, I went in and saw, and behold, every form of creeping thing and abominable thing, the idols of Israel portrayed on the walls round about. There were the men worshipping and offering incense to these gods. And then in verse 13, more idolatry. He said unto me, turn thee yet again, thou shalt see greater abominations that they do. And then, at the end of verse 14, there were women weeping for Tammuz. And then verse 16, he brought me to the inner court of the Lord's house. Between the porch and the altar, there were 25 men with their backs toward the temple of the Lord, and their faces toward the east, and they worshipped the sun toward the east. And so as a result, chapter 9 describes how in symbol those idol worshippers were going to be marked out and were to be killed. And then in chapter 10, still in this vision of Ezekiel taken back to the temple, we have the glory of God gradually departing from the temple and the city. It went by stages, went up stage by stage out to the gate, and eventually, as we see in chapter 11, verse 23, the glory of the Lord went up from the midst of the city and stood upon the mountain which is on the east side of the city. And that was the end of the vision. Afterward, the Spirit took me up and brought me in a vision by the Spirit of God into Chaldea, to them of the captivity. And then he relayed to them what was going on, what he had seen in vision in Jerusalem. Then, in the same year, see how intense were these prophecies, building up to this crisis in Jerusalem. He did, in chapter 12, he was told to remove all his goods out of his house in sight of the people as an object lesson of what was going to happen back in Jerusalem. The Jews have to remove all their stuff and take it into captivity. And again, then in chapter 13, that chapter is devoted to the false prophets, both in Judea and in Chaldea, who were proclaiming peace, but they were not going to see peace. verse 6, to wit, the prophets of Israel who prophesy concerning Jerusalem, which see visions of peace for her. And there is no peace, saith the Lord God. Then he goes on to condemn those prophets. And then, chapter 14, he emphasizes that this coming judgment is certain unless they repent. He cites the case in verse 14 of chapter 14. Though Noah, Daniel and Job were in Jerusalem, they wouldn't deliver the city by their righteousness. So the Jews who back in Jerusalem who had no such characteristics as those righteous men, they were not going to be saved. And then in chapter 15, we've got a very brief chapter. Jerusalem and Judah is likened to a vine, which are going to be completely burnt up. And then in chapter 16, we have another parable of two abandoned babies, Samaria and Jerusalem. Someone had taken pity on them and brought them up and cared for them and nourished them. But when they grew up, they were turned upon the one who looked after them. This was a symbol of, obviously, Judah and Israel, who had been brought up by God, but then turned against him. And then in chapter 23, we have... Sorry, I'm jumping ahead. Chapter 17, we have the parable of the two eagles. This reflects the political situation that we mentioned earlier. Two eagles were fighting over the Judean tree, plucking off its branches. And the two eagles were Babylon to the north and Egypt to the south. And in chapter 17 and verse 12 to 13, we've got Zedekiah's perjury. Say now to this rebellious house, know ye not what these things mean? Tell them, behold, the king of Babylon is come to Jerusalem, and hath taken the king thereof, and the princes thereof, and led them to Babylon, and hath taken of the king's seed, and made a covenant with them, and hath taken an oath of them, hath also taken the mighty of the land, that's Jehoiachin's captivity. And God was saying, well, Zedekiah made an oath with me. Then we know that he reneged on that, turned to Egypt, and that's what that parable of the two eagles is about. But chapter 18, God says that if a man repents, then despite what he's done, he's going to not be punished. Remember the references in, you know, chapter 18, if a man turn from his evil deeds, then I won't bring the punishment upon him. And then, chapter 19, we've got the parable of the lions. Again, these refer to the three kings of Israel who had reigned and were going to be destroyed. As a result, those lions were going to be captured. And so Judah would be kingless. Verse 14 of chapter 19. A fire has gone out of a rod of her branches, which hath devoured her fruit, so that she hath no strong rod, king, to be a scepter to rule. And that's what actually happened, wasn't it, when Zedekiah was killed. So that was a very, very busy year, that sixth year of the captivity. Now we come on to the seventh year. We're now only 2 years before the commencing of the siege of Jerusalem. And this commences with chapter 20 and goes on to chapter 23. The elders of Israel, we read verse 1, came to Ezekiel to inquire of God, but God said, I won't be inquired of you, you idolaters. And then in chapter 21, we've got that well-known passage where the king of Babylon is mustering his army to attack Jerusalem. Remember, it takes quite a while for a large nation to muster a military campaign in those. They set up all the supply chains and things like that. So although Zedekiah had rebelled some years before, it was maybe 2 or 3 years before Nebuchadnezzar actually got down there. So here we are 2 years before the siege. We've got the Babylonian sword now pointed at Jerusalem. You remember the reference, the king of Babylon stood in the parting of the ways, he looked in the liver, he consulted the arrows. You see, he wanted to know which way to go, and the arrows pointed to Jerusalem. With the result, verse 25, that well-known passage, "Thou profane, wicked prince of Israel, Zedekiah, whose day is come, when iniquity shall have an end, thus saith the Lord, remove the diadem, take off the crown, this shall not be the same. I will overturn, it shall be no more until he come whose right it is." And this oppression and this destruction was because of the unfaithfulness of Jerusalem. And in chapter 22 gives a catalogue of the sins of Jerusalem that were in fact precipitating this punishment. And then in chapter 23, under the vision of a holah and a holy bar, we've got the unfaithfulness of Judah and Israel, just as a wife falsely deserts her husband. And then in chapter 24 and 25, we come on to the ninth year. Now this is the year, the ninth year of the captivity, was the year in which the siege of Jerusalem actually commenced. Of course, the news wasn't known in Babylon, because the time would have taken quite a while for it to filter through. And here we have the siege actually commencing. Chapter 24, verse 1. "Again in the ninth year, in the tenth month, in the tenth day of the month, the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, Son of man, write thou the name of this day, even of this same day, the king of Jerusalem set himself against Jerusalem, this same day." A very auspicious day in prophetical terms. And so Ezekiel, God through Ezekiel, emphasizes it by another acted parable. He's taken to take a pot, boil meat in it, remove the scum, and then throw the meat away, and then heat up the pot till it was red hot. And that, God said, was Jerusalem. What's going to happen on commencing this very day that the siege started? And then a very sad thing happened that same day for Ezekiel. Read verse 15. "And the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, Son of man, behold, I take away from thee the desire of thine eyes with a stroke. Yet thou shalt neither mourn nor weep, neither shall thy tears run down. Forbear to cry, make no mourning for the dead. Bind the tie of thine head upon thee, put thy shoes upon thy feet, cover not thy lips, eat not the bread of men. So I spake unto the people in the morning, and at even my wife died, and I did in the morning as I was commanded." A poignant situation, wasn't it? Poor Ezekiel, he'd never been able to speak to his wife for the last 6 years, and there she was, had died. But again, God was showing that how terrible was going to be the effect on Jerusalem. But the one positive side of this was that once his wife had died, then there was some hope, maybe, that his dumbness would also be cured. Then from chapters 25 up to 32, Ezekiel directs his attention to the surrounding countries around Judah, and they were not to escape. And there are seven surrounding nations which are addressed there. And so we get on to chapter 29, And then we're now in the 10th year. And here, again, the political situation obtrudes in the prophecy, because Egypt is still trying to combat Babylon. And here in these two chapters, God is saying through Ezekiel that despite the uprise by Pharaoh Hophra, then Egypt was going to be punished and in fact eventually become completely subjugated by Babylon. And so we come on to the 11th year. This is a very active year, prophetically speaking, as befits the political situation. The siege in Jerusalem was going to come to an end this year. Jerusalem's captured and punished. A further wave of captives were going to come back to Babylon. And there's a series of prophecies, first against Judah's neighbours. And you can imagine how Ezekiel responds as the various information filters through about the Nebuchadnezzar's campaign down to the various nations. First of all, we've got the fall of Tyre predicted. That was the first nation that right up on the coast of now modern Syria. That would be the first nation to be attacked by Nebuchadnezzar. And in going back to chapter 26, we've got the fall of Tyre. Came to pass in the 11th year, and the first day of the month, Son of Man, because that Tyre has said against Jerusalem, ha, she is broken, then she was going to be punished. And in fact, Nebuchadnezzar set siege to Tyre for 13 years before it finally succumbed. And then in chapter 31, again in the third year, in the 11th month, we have the Egyptian tree is to be felled. And then we come to the fourth month, and that's the month that Jerusalem was actually taken. But of course, the news hadn't yet arrived in Babylon, but it did arrive the next year, in the 12th year. So here we have Ezekiel's prophecies shown to have come to pass. But we read in it's in chapter 32, I think, as soon as the news came through that Ezekiel's dumbness was sorry, I missed that out of my notes. Pardon?
33, verse
21. That's right. I'm sorry. I missed it out of my notes, thinking I would remember it, and then I didn't. Yes, that's right. And it came to pass, verse 33. It came to pass in the 12th year of our captivity, in the 10th month, in the 5th day of the month, the one that had escaped out of Jerusalem came unto me, saying, the city is smitten. Now the hand of the Lord was upon me in the evening, afore that he was escaped came, and opened my mouth. And my mouth was opened, I was no more dumb. So here's the news of Jerusalem's fall. And then the whole character of Ezekiel's prophecy changes. Because here we now have the restoration promised. Those wonderful chapters of 34, 35, God's promise of restoration. Edom was going to be punished because of their persecution of Israel. And then verses 36 and 37, the final restoration, reuniting of Judah and Israel. Then 38 and 39, going yet into the future, the overthrow of Gog. And then we come to chapter 40. In the 25th year, a long gap of 13 years when there's nothing recorded, we have in the 25th year of our captivity, in the beginning of the year, in the 10th day of the month, in the 14th day of the month, after that the city was smitten, in the selfsame day. So in exactly the same day that Jerusalem fell, Ezekiel, 13 years later, is given a wonderful vision of the future temple. The one that's been destroyed is going to be replaced. And we know the details of that. Ezekiel, the priest, revels, obviously, in the details of the new temple. And in the 27th year, we've got another reference to Babylon and the his wages, Egypt, for his siege of Tyre. And so ends the recorded ministry of 27 years. How much longer Ezekiel lived, we don't know. Well, what has our study told us about this man Ezekiel? Well, he was very faithful in proclaiming God's message. The hearers, originally at least, were very prejudiced against him, but we get the impression that at last they listened, even if all did not respond. It's an evidence of inspiration. The false prophets, their words didn't come to pass, but his did. And there's a lesson for us too. We are watchmen, as Ezekiel was. We have a divine message for our generation. Do we proclaim it as vigorously and with the same disregard for consequences as did Ezekiel? He suffered personal inconvenience. Are we prepared to do the same? We too have to make sacrifices for the truth, as he did. But we're told that he did as I was commanded. And yet his mission was generally successful. The idolatry that Israel and Judah took with them into captivity was largely eradicated by the time they returned. No doubt much of this was due to the influence of Ezekiel and other God-fearing men who guided the exiles into right paths. So as we read this prophecy, may we treat it not as a message from a long-lost and remote past, but as a book that contains the principles of acceptable behaviour that God will at last recognise as being worthy of incorporation into his perfect temple that was symbolised in the book of Ezekiel.